Paul Duane's Irish folk horror film, All You Need Is Death, is now playing in select theaters and on digital from XYZ Films. Beyondfest says, "You'll never be able to hear another folk tune without shivering in fear." David Jenkins of Little White Lies calls it grimly refreshing and confident. You can tell that everyone involved in the making really understood and appreciated the assignment. Watch the genuinely horrifying All You Need Is Death, available everywhere you buy movies.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. Today, we are revisiting the Hellraiser series. We have been here before. We will be here again. Maybe one day we'll do a mini-series. There's just so many of them. I'm excited to be talking about the 2011-era Hellraiser reboot by our friends Patrick Lussier and Todd Farmer. But most importantly, we have a very exciting guest with us today. He is a coworker with me at Dread Central. We have, and correct me if I'm saying your last name wrong, Tyler. We have Tyler Dupe?
You got it right. It's Tyler Dupe.
I get to keep this in then.
So. It must be because you're Canadian with all of the French.
It's got to be that.
With all of the French stuff.
Too much French stuff, to be honest. Too much French stuff in Canada. No, got to cut that. That's racist. Hi, Tyler. I'm going to keep it. Welcome to Development Hell. This is your first time here. I'm so excited to have you here. I was wondering, could you introduce yourself to the Development Hell audience?
I would love to introduce myself, but first I must say thank you so much for having me and that it's my pleasure to be here. In terms of who I am, I am a staff writer at Dread Central. I also work as the managing editor at wickedhorror.com. I've had bylines in Fangoria, RumOrg, and Scream magazines, the Sci-Fi Wire website, the Fandango movie blog, RIP, and just kind of across the internet. And I, like I said, just could not be happier to be here today. So thank you again.
So we're bringing in Hellraiser. We're going to get to our relationships with Hellraiser. But first, I'm going to say, you brought this as a topic. What I'm wondering, what came first for you? The interest in following Patrick Lussier and Todd Farmer as filmmakers or the Hellraiser franchise? Like, which one was the draw?
Oh, probably Farmer and Lussier. I love their collaborations. I love Trick so much. I for what it is, I really like My Bloody Valentine. You know, it's not really original, but I think it's a really fun companion piece. I enjoy Drive Angry. I think I'm one of probably a small number of people that actually really like that movie, just considering it's kind of a box office bomb. But I think it's a whole lot of fun. And I love, you know, I mean, I love both of them, you know, together. I love them individually. You know, even their projects that didn't necessarily land for everyone, you know, I think there's a lot to enjoy still about Dracula 2000.
I love it.
if you're not too critical, not too picky, you know, and just kind of take it for what it is.
Never mind Dracula 2000. What about Dracula Ascension, Dracula Legacy? Who knows what the third one's called? Into them all. Quicker down the line. But my big question for you right now, Hellraiser in you. Like, where is it with you in terms of, like, your franchises in the horror realm? Is it a top tier, middle of the realm? What's your relationship with Hellraiser?
It's in some ways kind of an odd man out for the fact that the first two are so good. Mm-hmm. I mean, just really good. And then it just kind of, you know, goes downhill from there. And even Judgment, which sort of got it, I don't know, a little bit back on track, was not great. So, I mean, it's just, there's a little bit of good and then there's so much bad. So I guess on that basis, it's somewhere in the middle for me, you know,
like, but
if it were just the first two films, I mean, those are near perfect. So
they are.
That's what keeps it from being, I think, lower on the list is just that those first two just really hit a cinematic sweet spot. They're scary. They're sexy. They're just so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I have so much love for both of them. The third one, though, for me, is very transitional because it's not as good as the first two, but it's a whole lot better than almost everything that followed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of that weird middle of the road type deal. The acting is just so bad. I mean,
it's not incredible in the third one. And you and I are actually going to be talking pretty in depth about Hellraiser 3 today. The truth of the matter is I had never seen it before recording today. And it is the first of the Dimension films Hellraiser series. So we thought, why not get into it a little bit? But I'm a fan. I was just saying to Tyler, they're a little gross for me. Sometimes gore, horror and me have a hard time being in the same room. I can handle it because it's incredible and it's queer, but sometimes that's hard for me. I love really shitty direct-to-DVD sequels from the middle of the 2000s. That's a sweet spot for me. And because of that, this series kind of I can watch some of those really bad direct-to-DVD ones with a little bit of love in my heart. Specifically, Hell World. Have you seen this one, Tyler? Number 8?
Yes, okay. That's the game, right?
Game. Yes, it's an internet rave-themed direct-to-video Hellraiser movie, which, okay. Yeah, and Henry Cavill's in it, and they're all in, some weird techno rave, and the slogan for it is "Evil goes online," and that makes me laugh every time.
Yeah, it really dates it, I think. I mean, that makes it very much a product of that era, because you would never give a film today a tagline like that.
No, it's hilarious. It almost makes it kind of post 2000s. You know, the 2000s are kind of in now with fashion and music. It's all kind of having a second wave.
Uh-huh.
And that movie kind of has that, I don't know, accidental 2000s aesthetic, if you're going to have a Pinterest board about it. If you had to pick one favorite sequel in the Hellraiser realm, which one would it be?
Well, definitely two.
Choose fantasy.
I like that it keeps a similar, I would say, tone and similar quality to the original, while sort of branching out and going in a slightly different direction. I love that the Kirsty character carries over, and I love the callbacks to the original, but it really is its own entity to be enjoyed, you know, as an augmentation of the first or as its own thing. And I think I love that about it, because I feel like I can't really say that about any other film in the series. I mean,
no.
Three comes about the closest to being almost good.
Sure.
It doesn't quite.
It doesn't get there. Number two kind of has this adult Jim Henson quality. It's very fantasy in a way that I really enjoy, and it's very fun. The first one is just so dark, but the second one is less scary to me because it has this open world fantasy vibe.
That's such an astute observation. I'd never thought of that before, but you're so right. It really does have a very kind of Jim Henson quality to it. I can see certain similarities to Labyrinth with kind of entering the other realm, much in the way that Jennifer Connelly's character does. in Labyrinth. And God, what about the Julia skin suit? That is one of the creepiest things I've ever seen.
It's gross. I would say the only Hellraiser movie that's grosser, I don't know. Me and Mary Beth, who also works at Dread Central, revisited Hellraiser 4 Bloodline not that long ago. And that might be the grossest one in the series. Thoughts on this?
I don't know that I've ever seen that. I've not seen a whole lot. Like, I've seen Judgment. I've seen Hellworld. I don't know that I've seen a whole lot. Oh, and then I saw the one where they recast Pinhead prior to
Revelations.
There was one. Yes, thank you. There was one before Judgment. Yeah, Revelations, where they recast Pinhead. I've seen that, and that was pretty god awful.
I hear that's the worst of all. I have not seen that one, but I do hear that's the most maligned. Well, this is when Dimension Films was really spitting them out because they had to by law. Are you familiar with why they were producing like $500,000 Hellraiser movies by the end there?
Certainly. They wanted to maintain their rights so that they could launch a reboot or, you know, continue to monetize the property, because they assume the rights would revert back to Clive Barker or whoever the original rights holder was.
Yes. So they literally just spat them out. Although they did give the last one, Judgment, which you've mentioned now, to, am I going to say this right? Gary Turncliffe, who is responsible for the majority of the like gore design for this franchise. And so this is an incredible artist who's like been with the series since day one, and I believe he directed Judgment. So it's nice to hear that they were keeping it in the family.
Definitely.
And he had another one that's been trapped in development hell for a while too, so maybe we'll get to that one day. Today, we did revisit Hellraiser 3, and I have to say, I'm really excited to get there, and we're going to get there pretty soon. But before we do, I was wondering if you were comfortable with it, Tyler. Could I give you and our audience just like a bit of a seminar on this Patrick Lussier, Todd Farmer, 2011 Hellraiser moment?
Oh, you bet. I think there are very few things I would love more than that.
It is in my wheelhouse of interests, too, so I relate with what you just said. As we've been saying, in 2011, filmmakers, specifically I would call them horror filmmakers, Patrick Lussier and Todd Farmer were writing not one, not two, but three plus treatments for Dimension Films for them to intend on rebooting this franchise theatrically. So I think one of the most important things to really get to is, who are Patrick Lussier and Todd Farmer? Well, we've covered them on the podcast before, all the way back with episode number 2. They are responsible for a Halloween script that almost made it, but didn't quite, called Halloween 3D. You can listen to our full episode about that with Emily Gagné if you go back in our feed. And we were talking about Dracula 2000, which is, I believe, the debut directorial effort by Patrick Lussier, who was a protege to Wes Craven. This guy was editing for Wes for tons of years, including a ton of his major releases like Scream and, if I'm not mistaken, New Nightmare.
I think you're right. I was just going to say that, actually.
Yeah, it may have been their first team up, but I don't know for sure. Maybe there was something direct to TV or something as well. These two, though, Farmer and Lussier, I believe, are kind of most famous in the horror world for their remake of My Bloody Valentine, My Bloody Valentine 3D, a late 2000s classic. And Dracula 2000 was a Lussier original. In your words, my friend Tyler, when I asked you who's Lussier and Farmer, what would you say? Like, who are they to you?
I don't know. I mean, I think that they are both talented individuals.
Yeah.
And I think that they have unique ideas. I think that Todd Farmer's script for Jason X really, for me, kind of got the franchise back on track. I mean,
it wasn't,
you know, a terrific entry, but it was fun. It was silly. It was gory. It was all the things that fans look for. And it just kind of shocks me that it's not more appreciated.
I'm also shocked, Tyler. This is something I think about all the time. People don't like that movie. Yes, it feels like a Canadian direct-to-video classic, but what's wrong with that?
Absolutely nothing. They're also a team that I think are great individually, but even better when they're together. I think that I think that Farmer's scripts with Lussier's direction really, I don't know, there's just something about it that works. Like, it's, you know, it's not fine art, but that's not what it's trying to be. I mean, it's entertaining. Their collaborations are entertaining, fun, silly, you know, just I don't know. I mean, I just have a great time seeing them work together.
They get it as horror filmmakers. You know, they're not too precious, but they're also taking the job seriously, which is a kind of a hard balance to juggle, especially when they were working at like big budget that they were doing, which was in the late 2000s. Like, that was a hard time to get horror right, and they did it. I also love Jason X.
Yeah. And I think they continue to get things right. I don't know if you've seen Trick, but that is...
I haven't, no, but I'm familiar. I love the conceit of it. Do you want to let us know, actually, in case people may not be aware?
I don't want to give too much away, but it's about a town that's haunted by a series of murders around the Halloween holiday. Cool. And it's a little bit giallo-esque in that you kind of get the impression that someone within the cast is the killer, but you don't know who. And it's just a really inventive slasher whodunit with some great kills and a really solid script. It's it deserves way more love than it gets. I think that it's a really quality film that deserves its moment in the spotlight.
Should I wait to Halloween to watch it, or could I just plop it on?
Whenever? Oh, you could watch it anytime. I mean, I think that, you know, if you like it as much as I suspect you might, you may just want to rewatch it when Halloween rolls back around.
I'll have it ready. It'll be in the artillery. Okay, cool. Yeah, we're fans. In case you don't know, we're fans of these two because they're cool and they make fun horror, and fun horror is what it's all about. We mentioned this because I'm just so obsessed with it. Back in 1992, we saw our first Dimension Films Hellraiser film, which is Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth. But it wasn't just their first Hellraiser movie. This was the first film Dimension Films ever put out, which is pretty wild because throughout the 90s and 2000s, this was kind of like the major horror production company. This was Blumhouse before Blumhouse. This was like a big deal. Unfortunately, there's so much baggage associated with Dimensions because of the head of house being the Weinsteins, and you can never forget about that, and we have to mention that whenever the Dimension films do come up. But Hellraiser being their first film kind of gives me, I don't know, kind of like house that Pinhead built kind of energy, which is kind of fun.
Absolutely, definitely. I think that Pinhead probably did for Dimension what Freddy did for New Line. You know, I mean, that really was their big bankable, you know, acquisition or, you know, property.
Mm-hmm. It definitely kind of put them on the map. But then they did squander that franchise. And as we all know, allowed the series to go direct to video for a long, long time. And quality suffered forever until 2022, this year, which is when we're going to see at least one big budget effort from Hulu. So this is the first time we're going to see a real Hellraiser film, if I say the word real. I don't know, since the 90s. So it should be interesting to see how that happens. But in 2011, Dimension wanted to go theatrical again. And so they decided to put out their feelers for a bunch of different pitches. And one of our episodes already on Development Hell is about a previous Dimension Hellraiser pitch by a Hollywood screenwriter by the name of Teddy Tannenbaum. This is the same time where we were looking to Lussier and Farmer to do the same thing. It never happened. We never got a late 2000s, early 2010s reboot. It just never came together. But it would have been cool to see what these two could have done with it. But before we get too much into what that could have looked like, would you want to talk a little bit about Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth with me, Tyler?
Oh, you bet. I would love to.
Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth is a 1992 American horror movie and the third in the Hellraiser films, directed by Anthony Hickox. Hope that's how you say that. Is it? Do you know?
That's how I say it.
Hickox. What a cool, fun name to say. And obviously stars Doug Bradley, Terry Farrell, Paula Marshall, and a little bit of Ashley Lawrence in there. This movie was written by our friend Peter Atkins, friend of the Hellraiser franchise for a long time. It made some modest money, about $12.5 million at the box office. And this was my first time watching it. How many times would you say you've seen this movie?
Well, counting leading up to this podcast, I think twice.
Cool. Not bad. Not bad. So this is three?
No, counting, rewatching it for this, I think I'd seen it twice total.
What would you say if I put you on the spot, gun to your head, you're shaking, I'm about to kill you if you don't do this. What is this movie about?
Oh God, I'd probably draw a blank and then I'd be dead.
You're dead. I killed you. And I meant it. I gotta go to prison. Sorry.
What is it about? Well, we see a new protagonist.
Yes.
And it's, you know, taking up the Kirstie role, so to speak, in Joey. Joey is a television news reporter looking into a series of violent crimes, murders that have been going on in her area. And she is not bad as a protagonist. She's no Kirstie Cotton, but you know, she's better than a lot of the people that kind of take over that role in subsequent efforts. Unfortunately, I would have to say that her co-stars, none of them can act.
I mean, I loved Terry. She wasn't good. I'm not saying she can act. I'm not saying anyone in this movie can act except for Doug Bradley.
I had a feeling you would like her, just the way that she kind of walks around with a cigarette and says sort of like sarcastic, you know, like goth inspired one-liners.
She's so iconic. I feel like we could popularize Terry. What would you? Okay, Terry, third build in this movie. Paula Marshall is Terry / Dreamer Cenobite / Skinless Lady. Who's this person? Like, what would you say her involvement in this film character Terry was? What was going on there?
Well, I mean, she's the sometimes girlfriend of JP, the sort of the catalyst for everything that's happening, because he's the one who acquires the statue with the lament configuration. She
was that at the end of the second one, the statue, or did the statue just come out of nowhere in this movie?
You know, it might have been at the end of the second one. I'm not positive, so I don't want to speak with any kind of certainty, but I do have a vague recollection of it maybe popping up, you know, in one of the final frames, but that'd be one of those things I'd have to go back and check to say for sure.
Okay. In case someone's wondering, well, there was like a statue in this movie with the lament box configuration in it, and then our like kind of like douchebag male lead gets a hold of it, and then Pinhead starts to like eat people through this statue, I guess, and then like slowly gets his powers back and like manipulates everyone because he wants to get out of the box. Is that, would you say that's correct?
I would say that's pretty correct. But the neat thing, the one thing that I did like about this movie, and I have to say there's more that I like about it than don't like, but one of the things I liked is that we get to see a little bit of Pinhead's humanity, a little bit of his, you know, pre-Pinhead existence.
Oh yeah.
And not only that, it's not like, you know, the Rob Zombie Halloween films where it really gives like a lot of backstory. You know, it's or like, you know, the Black Christmas movie, the 2006 remake, where it, you know, gave you all that about Billy and Agnes. It's just a little bit of an aside, which I love, because I don't like to be hit over the head with excessive backstory in follow-up efforts or prequels or whatnot. Like, I think sometimes keeping the killer a mystery, keeping their origin story a mystery, is, you know, less is more. But in this case, it just gives us a little bit, just a glimpse into his humanity, who he was prior to becoming the Hell Priest. And I really kind of liked that, because we see that he has a human side that we never see when he is Pinhead.
Yeah, we see quite a bit of Doug Bradley in this movie as Captain Elliot Spencer. I don't know if that worked for me as someone that, like, this was my first experience with it today in 2022. Uh-huh. I feel like it kind of softened Pinhead in a way that I don't know if he's meant to be softened. Just literally by seeing Doug Bradley's, like, normal mug. I was like, oh. It kind of, like, I don't know. It took away the edge for me in a way that didn't necessarily work. But it was absolutely interesting. And there's such a point. There's, like, a case to be made for doing it.
Yeah. Because,
it's ballsy.
Definitely. I think I liked that it didn't go too deep. You know, it wasn't a major subplot or, like, you know, like the secondary storyline. It was just kind of like a tertiary, we're going to throw a little bit of this in, which, you know, and for me it worked. Maybe on a repeat visit, you'll enjoy it more, or maybe you'll hate it even more than you did this time. Who knows?
I didn't hate it. I have to say, I actually quite enjoyed it, because it's just, it's camp. It's high camp. I would call this one high feminized camp. Especially when he like does his like hell sermon at the end, which I'm sure is like very famous because I do see that image pop up everywhere. They're really going Freddy Krueger with our boy Pinhead this time around. Like, he's getting sassier, and he's very sassy in this movie. He has a lot to say, and he's petty. He's just very petty in it. So I like that they go full, like, part four Freddy with him, but it does make it less scary to me, and therefore, I don't know, easier to access, I guess.
I agree that it's definitely less scary than the first two. You know, the tone is definitely a little bit different. And I think that the acting just not being that great takes me out of the film a lot.
Yeah.
And that in turn kind of makes it less scary for me.
It kind of felt a little bit, just like a little bit like the third Candyman movie.
Uh-huh.
Have you seen, what's it called?
Day of the Dead?
Yeah. Have you seen Candyman 3 Day of the Dead?
I don't know that I have. I really do enjoy the first two in the original canon.
Of course.
Never heard anything good about the third, so I haven't really made a point to speak it out. Do you have thoughts?
Oh, it's heinous. It's heinous, but I just love trash direct-to-video sequels, so don't ask me. I'm not the one. I don't know. I don't count. I want to talk about the Cenobites in this movie. Is that okay with you?
Oh, that's very much okay with me.
The ones that stand out in your brain, for me, gotta be DJ. I think it's just the DJ Cenobite with the CDs in the head, and then he kills you with CDs too. He throws them at you and you explode.
Right, and I think he shoves one inside of his head like a, you know, like a dashboard CD player in a car.
Yes.
And that's pretty tremendous. Like, you know,
incredible. Oh, wait, there's a DJ Cenobite and a CD Cenobite. Am I confusing the two?
Possible that you might be. I don't think.
Interesting. Because there got to be. That sounds like two different dudes. So I'm thinking definitely of the CD Cenobite.
Right.
That's just popping out. He's like one of those car CD players from like the late 90s where you could put like five in at once.
Yes. Like a five disc changer. Absolutely.
Yes. That's what he is to me. Very practical. would you say you have a favorite Cenobite in this movie?
Well, it would probably be him. I mean, he's certainly the most memorable, and he definitely plays into the whole, you know, kind of idea that film is very much a snapshot of its era. You know, you couldn't like see that for the first time today and be like, oh, wow, was that made in the last few years, maybe?
No. It could only have happened in 1992, right, where I'm assuming CDs were still kind of new and popular, but had been around long enough to become accessible. So I feel like it's got to be bang, 1992 only.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. There's also the camera head Cenobite in it, which the characters when he was alive, his name was Ken Carpenter, which I don't like because that seems heavy handed. So there is a person in this movie that is like the lead character, Joey, like her camera guy. Would you say like he's like the news like camera man?
Yes.
And he's sort of like a mentor to her in the movies, very nice to her, and then I guess he gets kind of taken by Pinhead at one point, and then his camera gets like absolved into his head, and then I guess it also can like turn into a flamethrower or a gun. It does like bad stuff too. Like, you don't want to be on camera because it'll kill you. And it's so silly.
He has like the lens or like the scope, whatever it's called, coming out of his eye too.
Yeah. Oh, it's out of the eyeball, of course.
Yes, he has the scope eyeball.
And it just looks like there's a bunch of putty like just like shoved on his head to hold it there. Like they didn't try the hardest. I would say with him. But they also didn't try that hard with J.P. Monroe when he turns into the piston head. I was confused by this. I wasn't exactly 100% sure of what was going on. So J.P. Monroe, that like hot evil guy that dies. Uh-huh. Remember the Cenobite that he turned into? I didn't really understand what that was and why he had to like click it and like it was like doing stuff. Was it a gun? Oh, it was a gun. Because piston means gun, right? I think he might have had a gun. I don't know. People are probably yelling at me in their car, like, obviously it's not. So, sorry, everybody. There's also the Dreamer Cenobite, who was the Cenobite version of our friend Terry, who we've talked about earlier, the sort of goth tragic figure that we're not really sure what she was doing in this movie.
Right.
Classic Cenobites. Classic Cenobite lineup in this one that I, you know, were kind of new and fun for me.
Yeah, I felt like Terry was kind of underutilized as a Cenobite. Mm. I mean, she didn't get... She had much better lines in her human role as compared to her turn as a Cenobite, which was unfortunate because, you know, she had some really kind of silly, quippy things to say. And I felt like they could have done a little more with that.
I loved her hair, too, as I think I've mentioned before. Straight and black, very goth girl, into it. So we were talking about before Joey, our lead character in this one, who kind of is replacing Kirsty to middling returns. She's okay. Like I think she could have been worse. It may have been her writing. The actor Terry Farrell may have done an okay job, in my opinion. Do you think it was more the acting that was bringing it down, or do you think she could have heightened it if she was a little stronger?
I feel like almost everything about the movie could be improved in one way or another. So yeah. It may be a case of a little bit of both, but I don't know. I feel like all things considered, she did well. I mean, she's certainly the most relatable character in the movie, and she's the only person in the movie other than Doug Bradley with any real prowess at acting. So I have to give her that. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that it was very middle of the road. And I think when it comes to a third Hellraiser movie, like, there are worse things that you can be. So, Terry Farrell, you got it. She also has a very funny line. Oh, yeah, where she's, like, talking to a priest. And she's like, there's demons. And the priest is like, no, they're just metaphors. And then Pinhead busts through the door. And she's like, well, then what the hell is that? And I'm still laughing. Or maybe she says, fuck. But she says something funny.
I thought that was an interesting line for the priest to say, you know, just because, like, unless you're some kind of very, like, Unitarian type religion, normally you accept, you know, if you're, like, entrenched in the Christian faith, you accept that, you know, the Bible's meant to be taken literally. So I thought that was a really interesting choice by the screenwriter to actually have him say that, because it, I don't know, kind of flies in the face of a lot of the kind of popular tenets of Christianity.
It's interesting. I clocked that too. I thought that was kind of a nice perspective for a man of cloth to have. It might kind of speak to writer Peter Atkins, who's been around quite a long time in the Hellraiser world, that he the writing of this movie is not like the best in the whole world, but he's got some chops. He makes some interesting choices, even in this movie, and I have to say, in the fourth one, too, even though that's fairly maligned, he thinks outside of the box, and that is a pun? Is that a pun? Like, you know, like the Hellraiser box.
Yes, yes, no, definitely. I think that counts as a pun.
Thank you. So, do we have any final thoughts on Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, before we move along?
Yeah, I do, which is just to say that I had very mixed feelings about the sequence near the beginning where the patient on the stretcher comes in with the chains attached, convulsing from electric shock until his head explodes.
That
felt a little too extravagant to be so close to the beginning, because I feel like if you're going to do that at the start of your movie, you have to continuously one-up that with each subsequent kill, and nothing one-upped that. You know, the finale was a lot of fun, but it was nowhere near as, you know, outrageous as that. So in some ways it kind of falls flat because it's great, but then it's like everything that comes thereafter feels like it pales by comparison.
I agree completely. And also it's confusing when it does happen right at the top. You're like, it's strange that this man still... Seeing someone have those Hell World chains on them in a naturalistic setting without Pinhead was very weird. It's like, I don't think those should be visible right now. Like, with a bunch of doctors in the bright, like, fluorescent lighting, these chains are visible? It didn't really make any sense to me.
I had the exact same reaction. That whole scene felt very surreal. Like, is this a dream? Because this doesn't feel like this should really actually be happening in the real world right now. This feels like, you know, like a dark fantasy or a dream or a nightmare, but it doesn't feel like this is what's actually going on. It felt kind of clunky and out of place for me.
I agree. I feel like it didn't really make sense. And yeah, it doesn't really get to that level throughout the rest of the film. It's a middling Hellraiser movie. You know, it's not the worst one, but it ain't anywhere near the height of the first two. So I don't know. Would you say there's been a wave of appreciation with this movie in recent years? Or do you think that hasn't happened for it yet?
I haven't heard a lot of people singing its praises. Horror journalist Nat Bremmer is not a staunch supporter of the film, but he definitely will defend it. You mm-hmm. know, I've seen him write about kind of what it could have been or what it tried to be, and he seems to always think of it positively. But I can't think of a lot of other people off the top of my head that, you know, really sing that film's praises.
Yeah, it's just not great, and that's okay. You know, I celebrate that for this movie. My final thought on it is this movie, I think because of it, I can't say for sure. One of the things I say a lot lately is I'll just call stuff hell on earth. Like, if I don't like it, I'll be like, oof, that's hell on earth. And I must have taken that from this, right? Because, like, I'm not sure where else I would have heard that. Although, is it just a popular idiom?
I think that is a popular idiom. I mean, I think that's something, you know, my mom would say when I was growing up, like, you know, before that movie had even come out. So I think they adapted that because it was fitting as a subtitle.
I think I have a psychic connection to this movie, actually.
And that makes so much more sense.
It's just me in this movie, actually, hell on earth. So I don't know why you're discrediting that. But out of five, what do you give this? Out of five bloody chains, how many bloody chains are you giving to Hellraiser 3, hell on earth?
It's hard to say because I feel like it's middle of the road, but I also want to say it's a 3. Because I feel like a 2.5 would be too low, but a 3 almost feels too high. So maybe like a 2.75.
I am not a fan of a 2.75 or a 2.25, but you know what? You're right. It is 3 is too high for this movie, but 2.5 does feel too low. So it's in the liminal space.
It's close to being really good. I mean, it has a really balls-to-the-wall finale, and it has some great sequences, and it has an okay character in Joey. And the JP situation is kind of interesting, like how he's, you know, bringing in women to seduce like Julia was doing with men. So, I mean, there are so many things about it that are good, but nothing great, and some things that are less than good. So, it, you know, it makes it a hard one to give a rating to and feel totally fair about it.
Well, I'm waiting. You said 2.75. I agree. This is a C+. We love it. And I'm sure I'll watch it many more times before I die.
I actually liked it more the second time. I think the first time I was so disappointed that I said never again.
Yeah, because it's not the first two, no way.
No, it's not. But I think I was almost pleasantly surprised this time just to see that it had some of the characteristics that make the first two great. So it was, I don't know, that made me appreciate it more than I did the last time. You know, I'll never call it a great film. And, you know, I'll never say that it gets everything right, but it's better than I remembered. So, you know, that is something positive I can say about it.
And it sort of was the reason for the direction horror took in the 90s, because I don't know, it had a major influence with Dimension Films coming about. It was the very first film, as we said, to ever be released through them. And then fast forward through the future, you get to 2011, and Dimension Films are like, we want Hellraiser back. We want to put Pinhead back in theaters. And who are they going to? They're going to Todd Farmer and Patrick Lussier for a bunch of treatments. So, as we promised, we're going to get in a little bit into what this movie could have looked like under Farmer and Lussier, based on a couple of articles from Bloody Disgusting and honestly some cool quotes from Patrick Lussier himself, as he did a bunch of interviews around 2010 to 2015 era. Would you mind if I gave you a couple of these quotes from the mouth of Lussier himself?
No, I can't think of anything I'd enjoy more at this moment.
We're fans. So in 2010, he was speaking to MoviePhone And there's an interesting quote. He said, on the film, "We are officially a go. We want to work within the massive Hellraiser mythology that exists and create something unique. We think Clive's film stands on its own. We think it's brilliant. It had such a specific dark vision that at the time was unlike anything that had come before it. So to just remake a movie of his, but with more money, is not something that we wanted to do. We wanted to work within the Hellraiser lexicon." Were you familiar that around this time that there were rumors they were trying to go PG-13 with this franchise?
I did hear some rumblings about that, and I remember just thinking, wow, what a fool's errand, you know, to try to take a very adult movie that's like almost pushing NC-17, you know, and then market it as, oh, this is kind of family friendly.
Yeah, really weird. Like, just the subject matter to talk about in conversation would get it up to PG-13. I don't know how they would have ever managed to do that. But these rumors were addressed by Patrick Lussier in the same interview. And this is what he had to say about that. He said, "Oh, God, no. We definitely did not want to do that. We wanted to make a grown-up movie. The sequels all went on to be smaller in scope, but our idea was that if we're going to make it, let's be epic and explore the doorways and opportunities Clive created. Always keeping in mind that what he did and how he did it. There's a part of this world that we're not allowed to see because there's never been the resources to show it. So let's show it." God, poor babies. I really wish they could have made their movie. But I really like what they're saying about Clive Barker here, because Clive Barker is kind of the king in some ways of epic horror, especially with his literature. Are you a Clive Barker fan? Like, do you have like a history sort of stanning Clive?
I wouldn't say that I have a history of stanning him. Haven't delved into his literary works nearly as much as I would like to say that I have. But I have, truthfully, a lot of blind spots in terms of literature. Like, I didn't start reading Stephen King until I was in my 30s. And, you know, I will eventually get around to reading as much of Clive's work as possible. But really, my appreciation for him mostly stems from adaptions like Midnight Meat Train, Candyman, Hellraiser, etc.
Cool.
So, I can't say that I'm as well-versed in his prose as I wish that I was.
Same. I'm the same as you. The one novella of his that I've read is The Hellbound Heart, which honestly is quite similar to Hellraiser. Like, it's not a completely different kettle of fish. Don't know if that's a saying.
I think that is, but that's one of the really neat things about it is that, you know, you've got the creator in control, you know, writing the screenplay and, you know, putting his touches on it rather than, you know, being so far removed from the process and not even really recognizing what he started out with.
And I love a queer horror icon. We don't have too many of them yet. They're starting to grow, but especially for the 80s and before, having someone like Clive Barker in the machine was just like really inspiring.
Yeah,
you know, no, as a queer creator in the space too. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would love to see more creators write and direct adaptations. And I know that maybe we don't see that as much because of, you know, Maximum Overdrive, you know, where Stephen King tried to, you know, kind of take the directorial reins and failed sort of miserably, at least according to most fans and critics and anyone that's seen the movie. But, you know, I mean, Clive Barker really proved that that can go quite well as going, you know, off the rails, insanely bad.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with you. I think Stephen King kind of gave it a bad name, but I love to see it. And I think I'd like to see it more, especially from queer people. Yeah, I have a couple more quotes that I'd like to deliver from Lussier from around this time. So he was on the Movie Crypt podcast. Are you familiar with these guys?
Oh, of course, with Adam and Joe.
Yes, yes. So he was on that podcast. I forget what year this was. And he was talking about this film. And here's what he had to say. See, the idea essentially was that we never got to see the story of Frank getting the box from the first film. So imagine if Frank is actually the darkest version of Jack Bauer from 24 and Nicolas Cage basically from National Treasure. It would have been the evil National Treasure movie. I don't know how serious he is about this, but I actually see exactly what he means in terms of like scope and archetype of character. it being a Frank movie. Did this make sense to you as a quote? Like, could you see what he was saying, or do you think he's being silly?
God, I don't know. I don't feel like I see... I don't feel like I identify with the quote as much as you do. I remember reading that and just kind of thinking, well, you know, I mean, how does, you know, the head of a counter-terrorist unit become this, like, I don't know, pleasure and pain seeking, like, freak of a character. I just couldn't really meld the two together. So
maybe it helps that I've never seen 24. Maybe that helps. Maybe it helps my cause.
I feel like that would help a lot. Have you seen National Treasure?
No, but that I have interest in. That I think I'd enjoy. But no, I haven't seen either.
Okay, well, but I mean, both of those are like good guys, like, you know, trying to, I mean, neither one of them is even like an anti-hero. So imagining one of them as Frank, being familiar with both of those properties was really hard for me to sort of see.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But I think I see it as more of there's this protagonist in Frank that is having to go on this epic, like, journey to the center of the earth, basically, because of this box. So we have this, like, gross character who's, like, escaping hell, but you're going to open the scope and have him sort of be on this, like, high-tensity treasure hunt, basically. And I think that could have been kind of fun.
But isn't he also kind of the new Pinhead in that script?
Yes! So, interestingly, you were saying this. Yes, so in at least one of these three treatments these two guys were coming up with, yes, Uncle Frank from the first film was essentially going to portray the new Pinhead. He was going to be the big, scary archetype. And on that, from the same podcast, from the Movie Crypt episode, Patrick Lussier says, in the beginning, Frank is going to get the box, but he's in Shanghai. He gets caught, and they hold him down, and they hammer these fucking nails into his head, but he gets free, and he kills everyone. But he does get the box, which is being held by this guy who looks like he's all bloated and has been ripped apart by Cenobites. Frank steals the box and then bad things happen. Yeah, this bloated guy, we're going to get to you more later. Mule was his name in one of these scripts. It's really gross. But yeah, it does seem like, you know, he was probably, Frank was going to get some pins in his head at some point in the script.
Do you think Patrick Lussier should be using such spicy language, though?
I don't know. You're right. I don't think it feels comfortable coming from such like a proper gentleman.
Yeah, I don't know if he
should. Todd Farmer, yes. Todd Farmer, I see it for. But
I could definitely see it from Todd Farmer.
I would expect it. I would be disappointed if it didn't come from Todd Farmer.
Following him on social media, I could definitely see it from him.
I believe you on that. And I love that for him. I love that brand. But yeah, I agree. Lucy kind of seems so like soft-spoken to me. But
a little
I don't
more
know
reserved.
Yeah, like British energy. Don't know the guy, so maybe he's really buck wild. Who knows? You know, maybe he's out here being crazy.
Well, maybe
either way, I support him.
Maybe you should have him on here to defend himself and his use of spicy language.
I would love that. Patrick Lussier, if you're listening, let's chat some more. So what do you think of Uncle Frank, who in the first film was this, basically, as you were saying, you brought up the word catalyst earlier, but he's the one that unleashes the box, gets sent to hell, and throughout the first film is communicating with some evil lady named Julia to try to help bring him back. And so in this Lussier film, we were going to focus possibly on this character. I would say he is not the reason that I am here in this franchise. It's all about Julia. Why aren't we talking about her? That's how I feel.
I think that's a great point. I think Julia is a really tremendous character. You know, she's a strong female character. She's got distinct anti-hero / villain energy. And I couldn't imagine the original without her. She's in many ways, perhaps the most memorable character, that how ruthless she is and how desperate to get laid she is.
She wants it. And it can't be that good because he doesn't have any skin, but she doesn't care.
Well, I mean, they certainly had some good times together in the past to make her, you know, resort to murder to bring him back so she can once again, you know, do those things.
I was listening to a fellow Dread Podcast Network show, Girl That's Scary, not long ago, and they were talking about Hellraiser. Check out that episode if you haven't already. And they said something along the lines of, I hope this is verbatim, but basically, like, no dick is worth that. And I think I stand by that. Like, no dick is worth that level of gross, bloody mess. Like, it's just not worth
that.
It.
I will co-sign that statement for sure.
Thank you. You know, I think it's a fairly controversial statement, but I think it needed to be said by not me, but our friends at Girl That's Scary. Yeah, it's just not worth it, Julia. You can find other sickos. There's so many of them out there.
Certainly. I assume it's probably more than just the phallus for her, but
yes. But I think the phallus is the metaphor. I think when they say dick, I think the dick is the metaphor for the man. That's my interpretation.
I think you're right. I was just being
No, I know. Tyler, would you be interested in hearing a little bit of the details from one of these three Lucie Farmer treatments about Hellraiser?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
There was a cool article in 2019 on Bloody Disgusting by Brad Mitzka, where he got a hold of one or two of these treatments and basically kind of gave us a bit of a synopsis, and they're pretty interesting. Basically, the toy maker engineer from the fourth one and prior is included, which is kind of cool, but they also included new facets of mythology in this treatment. They have these people called toy breakers, which is kind of the inversion of the toy maker, I suppose, a secret group of people that all they want to do is find and destroy all possible gateways to hell. And I think that's a great way to dedicate your time. So in this breakdown by Mitzka, we get a character by the name of Lisa, who's orphaned as a baby. And so we have this big opening sequence where you see how she's orphaned. Her whole house explodes. It's really scary and sad, and her parents die. But we're introduced to two of the main Cenobites of the film by the name of Black and White. And they're sort of like, you know, like opposites, the yin and yang of hell, which is, I think, a little silly. And we also meet early on the main big monster evil dude of this film. And his name is Glass. And he's basically a Cenobite with like stained glass coming out of his head, which I think is actually kind of cool. So we also meet these two main toy breakers by the name of Blythe and Truman. These are the dudes that all they want to do is cut off all the gateways to hell. And further down the line, we're seeing Lisa as a young adult, like 19 or something, with a bunch of her friends. And these are our lead characters in this film. Early on, they're hospitalized after a car wreck. And we see at the hospital, there's this overweight man by the name of Mule. And I believe, if I recall correctly, this guy was also responsible for the death of her family at the beginning. So we see that she's sort of not able to escape the puzzle box. Like, the puzzle box is always coming for you, Lisa. Don't you forget it. So Mule arrives and, like, cuts the puzzle box out of his tummy, which is sad. I don't like that for Mule. And, yeah, so the puzzle box arrives. Presumably someone opens it. And the hospital is overrun by Cenobites, minor sort of like government level Cenobites referred to as Lobites, which I don't like because it reminds me of low lights. And I don't think Cenobites need that. Pinna shows up and is defeated fairly quickly. And that is a very quick rundown of what could have sort of happened in maybe one of these treatments. What did you take from that little story I told you? Did any of that land in your heart? Did that make sense at all to you?
I mean,
how did I do personally?
Great because you always do.
Oh my god!
I think that it just sounds kind of epic. I mean, it's possible it could have gone horribly wrong, but it just sounds so epic and so expensive and so kind of polished. And I would have loved to have seen that realized. I think that, you know, it's been so long since we've seen a big budget Hellraiser movie, and I know that we have one coming to Hulu. But I mean, that would have been pretty major, and it'd just be interesting to see where the franchise would be now had that trilogy of films actually been realized. Wasn't 3D fatigue kind of setting in by that point, or did that not start until later, do you think?
I think it's gotta have been. It could not have been long after the peak, which was, right, what, 2009?
Well, isn't it interesting, though, how Farmer and Lucier kind of kickstarted the 3D thing with My Bloody Valentine?
Invented it. Yeah. They were there 1933, first time. They will never die. Yeah, I think for sure, at least in the horror realm, because everything after that, like, we learn they were the go-to guys. Like, we wanted a Halloween 3D. We wanted a Hellraiser 3D. Like, they were throwing every franchise at these two after they did that one.
I remember interviewing Todd Farmer for my blog when I just first started writing. And cool. I think I remember him saying that the 3D cameras were like the size of a refrigerator. And I just find that so interesting to think about.
How do you move it?
I want to see that in action.
I know. I mean, I'm sure that it's much different now. I imagine the technology has, become much smaller.
It's just a pair of Google glasses. That's right. All.
It probably is.
Just like fact. Put it on Greta Gerwig and you got a movie.
Indeed.
I'd watch
that movie. She kind of has the golden touch, doesn't she?
I cannot wait. She's making a Barbie movie and it's going to be good. It's going to be good. I don't know about you, but I feel ready to land into conclusion territory. How do you feel about that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Let's conclude this shit.
So you may be aware, maybe you're not aware, but on this podcast, we decide, we are the suits. We will say if this stands a shot at the green light. But if it doesn't, that's up to us too. So this is a lot of weight on our shoulders. So Tyler, I have to ask, will we ever see a Farmer Lucier Hellraiser movie at some point in the future?
I mean, if it were up to me, yes, we absolutely will. Realistically speaking, probably not. I can't think of too many instances where a project has fallen through and someone has gone back to that screenwriter and said, "Oh, I want you to do this again." So, realistically speaking, I don't think there's any chance. But you know, if I were the one greenlighting it, you know, it would go into production tomorrow.
Well, it looks like we got to give them a call because they're going to Hollywood. What is next for Hellraiser? Tyler, do you know? Are you familiar? What's going on with this franchise?
Well, I know that we have a female Pinhead coming up in a big budget sort of reimagining relaunch of the franchise. Yeah. But I don't know a lot of details, so I'd love it if you could fill in the gaps.
So we have our friend David Bruckner, who is kind of a new kid to the horror scene. He directed, I believe his first film was The Ritual for Netflix, a very spooky in the woods horror. And then this year he released, a big horror moment, which was The Night House, which was on a lot of people's best of the year list. Was it on yours, Tyler?
No, it was not. But that was not necessarily an omission, more so than I just didn't get to it in time.
Fair enough. It's an interesting one. It's definitely thinking outside of the box. It's very spooky existential horror. There are some Hellraiser like grotesqueness to it that might be an interesting slide over, who knows. So this is a choice of director that I am interested in seeing what he does with it. And yes, we have our first female Pinhead, which is so exciting, and it's going to Hulu, so I assume that means it's going to be direct to streamer. So I don't know, that we might have different mixed feelings on that, because it'd be nice to see a Hellraiser movie in theaters.
But don't you think, though, that there's a huge difference between direct-to-video and direct-to-streaming? Because direct-to-streaming can have a $30, $40, $50 million budget.
Yep, absolutely. But it does kind of still feel like it's in the middle. No matter how big the budget, doesn't it kind of still feel like it's not getting... It's an emotional thing.
I don't have that association with it necessarily, because I think that in some ways, streaming is kind of the next chapter for, big budget films. Or maybe not the next chapter, but it's a perfectly respectful alternative to theatrical. And some of the streamers, like Amazon, will even release some of their stuff into theaters. So the lines are becoming blurred. And, I don't think of direct to streaming as less than in any way necessarily.
Interesting.
I think that it can very much be on a par with, there are theatrical films that are made for so much cheaper than stuff that's made direct for streaming. So it's hard for me to see it in any way as not entirely equal just on the basis of where it's launching.
You know what? You're changing my mind. You're here. You're changing the world, and that's important.
Well, I'm here and I'm queer, so we're here and we're queer. Get used
yes.
to it.
Imagine if someone hadn't known that. They're like, Josh is straight. Well, now illusion is shattered.
Oh, no, I've just
you outed me. How dare you? I am actually straight, though. So I don't know what you're talking about, actually. That's crazy that you think that. Tyler, my friend, yes. Where can you be found on the internet if you want to be found?
Oh, well, I would like to be found. And mm-hmm. you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at funwithhorror, FunWithHorror. Mm-hmm. And you can also find me at facebook.com/funwithhorror. I like to just keep it simple, you know?
I love it.
Keep that username the same across the platforms. So please look for me.
And he will be found. Thank you so much. This has been a really fun one. It flew by. Stay where you are. I'm going to hit stop, but I don't want you going anywhere. Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. And we'll be back with another episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.